Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Swedish acting legend Stellan Skarsgård talks to me about his starring role in the new series of Andor, as long as it's showrunner and creator Tony Gilroy. A fascinating new documentary all about Irish priests and confession boxes called Sins of Ireland from Alex Fegan. Plus, all the week's new movie releases, including the much talked about Alex Garland Warfare, the movie people are calling the most graphic war movie of all time. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well. Now, we usually start the show talking about TV and what I was watching and what you were watching, but I just, and if you've heard about this all week, I forgive me, but I just have to say the most important, poignant piece of TV I watched all week was Rory McIlroy winning the Masters. And I have never watched golf on TV ever for longer than about a minute. I have a strange relationship with golf, having spent a summer as a caddy in Long Island and not enjoying it very much. I turned my back on golf for my own ridiculous, short-sighted reasons. But so I haven't watched golf in a long time. And I, like everyone else, was utterly blown away. And I particularly love his inability to control his emotions. You know, it's just nice to see someone not be able to talk because they are so overcome. And it was such honest emotion. I just thought it was wonderful. And as I say, my first time watching golf in a long time. Probably won't be watching it again for a long time. No disrespect to the golfers out there, but it's just my long, tortured history with golf. But Shin Scale Ella. So I hope you're well, whether or not you watch the Masters. I hope you're having a nice Easter weekend thus far. And outside of the golf and TV, I was watching this.
You're 27?
28.
28, so you're 20 years younger than me. And at this moment in time, it works, right? I have money, you have freedom, we could travel the world together, we could learn things from each other.
Conversation and in bed.
Yeah. Right. You'll find me very interesting because I have 2 decades more worth of stories than you. And I find you very interesting because you live your life in the moment with kind of a reckless immediacy that I lost a million years ago. So we'll have no trouble keeping each other entertained. And that'll work for a while. Skip ahead 10 years. You'll be 38. I'll be 58. That's when things can start to get a little shaky. You might want kids. I already have them. You might start thinking, oh, have I missed out on one of life's great experiences? And you'll still be stunning.
You think I'm stunning?
I'll be aging.
Well, I can tell you're going to age very well.
You can tell that because it's already started to happen. The point is that we'll have less sex and more wine, and maybe that'll still work for a time.
Has anyone ever told you that you talk a lot?
Well, I misplaced my inner monologue and my wife right around the same time.
That is the great John Hamm having an interaction with a much younger woman in a bar. This is Apple TV's Your Friends and Neighbors. There are 2 episodes up there. It dropped last week, I believe it was. We did it on Pat Kenny's Boxed this week, and Pat loved it. And Pat's right, because it is great. John Hamm hasn't done a lead acting role in a series since Mad Men. And in a way, there's something, this is almost a yin and yang of Don Draper to an extent. I may be forcing the analogy a bit, but what it is Don Draper is this highly successful hedge fund manager, not a head fund, that's something different, a hedge fund manager, and he's making lots of money, married, kids, life is going well, upwardly mobile. His wife leaves him, first of all, for a good friend of his. Then he has a one-night stand with that woman you heard. Then they sack him from his job because he was not meant to, even though he didn't know that, and she works in a different department. So he's kind of hitting the skids. He can't get hired because of a contract in his previous employer, a non-solicitation thing, so he can't really get work for the next 2 years in hedge fund management. So he decides he's going to start robbing the houses of his friends and neighbours. And it is really funny and really watchable. And as you can tell, when people become criminals, generally, it doesn't work out that well. It doesn't work out that well. I've seen 5 or 6 of these. It is great. It really is. It's very funny. And John Hamm is a revelation. I didn't think he could do funny this well. He was funny in Bridesmaids, but it's a very small part. But he does funny really well in this. And he gets up to some strange stuff that's very compelling. Like when he's going to pawn shops with watches he's robbed from his neighbours. This is probably a study of kind of the underbelly of rich Americans. But that's only part of it. It's mostly wildly entertaining and funny. So a big thumbs up for Your Friends and Neighbours, now streaming on Apple TV. There are only two episodes. They're dropping weekly. That's the rub with Apple TV. You have to wait, but it's worth the wait because it's very good. Now, we don't really have time to get into all of this because The Last of Us returned on Sky Atlantic and on Monday night. The Last of Us, the first series, was absolutely brilliant. Not everybody loved it, but a lot of people absolutely adored it. About a post-apocalyptic America, now infiltrated by zombies. Pedro Pascal is traveling across this post-apocalyptic America. Bella Ramsey is a child in his care who has some very important role to play in this zombie apocalypse. I won't say any more than that. People raved about season one, and in particular they raved about one episode, episode 3, that was kind of like a standalone movie in and of itself. I've only seen the first episode. That's all I've seen of series one, so I'm on the same page as you. But based on episode one, we're in for a brilliant, brilliant ride. You know, this is based on a video game, and history would tell us that doesn't work out well. That may be changing based on recent things, but particularly with The Last of Us, because season two is shaping up very, very nicely indeed based on the first episode of season two. It's 5 years ahead. Pedro Pascal is now in Wyoming, I think it is, and stuff is coming down the tracks. I won't say any more than that, but it is great. Prestige TV, it's a commitment. Some people found season one a bit slow. I loved it. Lots of people loved it. But, you know, that's the gravy of these things. I don't even know what that means. But, you know, let me know what you think of Last of Us. If you might have been watching Your Friends and Neighbours on Apple TV, and indeed, if you might have watched The Golf, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now, this week in TV, I was also watching this.
I came with you to be part of something. The Empire cannot win. It's a different kind of mission. If it goes up in flames, it will burn very brightly.
But if I'm giving up everything, I want to win. We have to. Stand together, we will be crushed.
Resistance is absurd.
It's a weapon. They're building a weapon. The monster will come for us all.
Now, that is a clip from Andor from Disney Plus. Andor was the Star Wars show from it's nearly 3 years ago at this stage, which was loved by Star Wars fans, and I think even made an impact beyond Star Wars fans, because it is by general consensus the most adult version of it, to the point that a character in the first season visits a brothel. So this was not one for kids, and it was excellent. Diego Luna plays the aforementioned Andor, Cassian Andor, who spent the first season on the run. He's a thief, but he's becoming a rebel who's ultimately going to fight the Empire. Andor begins as kind of a show that was a sequel to Rogue One. So the whole series is leading up to Star Wars Rogue One. Now, if you don't know anything about Star Wars, none of this makes a huge amount of sense to you. But that said, this is a very credible sci-fi show, even if you know nothing about Star Wars, I promise you. Now, season two begins 5 years after where season one left off. Cassian Andor is becoming a key player in the Rebel Alliance that's ultimately going to take on the Empire, which is where Rogue One begins and kind of ends. And what people love about it is that it's rife with political intrigue, danger, tension, high stakes. ultimately getting ready to do a huge battle with the Empire and its Death Star. And Cassian Andor's journey is a bit like Han Solo's from the original movies. He's a cynical nobody who's on the way to becoming a rebel hero. Now, season two, I've watched most of it at this stage because I was sent it a while ago. And I don't want to give many spoilers because they've begged us not to. But it continues in the same vein as series one. These are like mini mega Star Wars movies, I found. And I would plead with you, even if you think you don't like Star Wars, I think you would like Andor. One of the great characters in Andor, and he's back in season two, is Stellan Skarsgård. And he betrays this guy called Luthen Rael, who's a mild-mannered shopkeeper. He sells kind of antiquities and antiques, and it's a beautiful gallery. And he's kind of part of the elite, and he wears this wig. He looks like a composer to me. But he's hiding in plain sight because that's his disguise, because he's actually a Star Wars rebel. And he was one of the key characters, and he continues in season two of Andor. So I got to talk to the great Stellan Skarsgård, who I spoke to 2 years ago for Dune 2, or maybe it was last year. A phenomenal actor that needs very little introduction. The Swedish actor in everything from Breaking the Waves to Mamma Mia to Dune 2, as I mentioned, to Good Will Hunting, brilliant in Good Will Hunting. A terrific actor married to an Irish woman. I also spoke to him along with Tony Gilroy, who's a screenwriter who wrote The Bourne Supremacy and The Bourne Identity and wrote Rogue One and created Andor. And he's very keen that this, as I was saying, be seen as a show you can get into, even if you're not into Star Wars. I won't belabor the point. So here's my chat with the great Stellan Skarsgård and Tony Gilroy. Hi, guys. How are you? Greetings from Dublin, Ireland.
Hi, how are you?
Good to see you.
Very good. Stellan, I spoke to you for Dune 2 last year or the year before, and I remember you kind of saying to me, you know, worms in the sand and spaceships don't really float my boat, but what does is great human drama and politics written into stuff. It seems to me Andor's a lot like that, not to talk about Dune, but that, you know, you may not be into flying spaceships, but there's loads going on here politically and human drama-wise, and that continues in Andor to be the appeal for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, I'm not a big fan of sci-fi, except because it's when as long as it is sci-fi, just the core of sci-fi, the new gadgets of sci-fi and everything. I'm always looking for the human being, but of course, also it's also my job. I mean, I can't portray any f***ing sci-fi things. I can't portray human beings, And this one was I was reluctant first, but when Tony showed me the first episodes of the first season, the tone of it was so compelling that I say no.
Yeah, Tony, yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of people my age say this kind of stuff to you. I was 5 when I went to see The Empire Strikes Back, and, you know, it changes the courses of lives. And Star Wars fandom is, as you well know, is all-encompassing around the world. But the reason why I mentioned The Empire Strikes Back is my daughter is watching all the movies now, and she doesn't like The Empire Strikes Back because it's too dark. And in a way, Andor reminds me of The Empire Strikes Back in a lot of ways, because we know where this show is going to end, possibly, and it's going to be dark. Do you have a sense that you're telling, you know, a dark part of the Star Wars story? I don't mean to keep saying the word dark, but
I mean, the mandate was not to make a show for kids. We weren't going to have the Force. We weren't going to have lightsabers. That was all part of the discussions and the exploration we did before we got involved. I mean, there's plenty of the other. This hadn't been done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just as interested in, I'm really interested in the audience that is Star Wars averse or yeah. Star Wars reluctant. And, a really big part of my year in the last year or two is running into friends who say, "Oh, I love all your work, man. When are you making a movie?" I go, "Well, I've been on this thing all these years." And, "Oh yeah, but it's Star Wars." And like, I want that audience as well. I think there's a vast untapped reservoir of people that are reluctant. It's hard for Star Wars fans to realize that, but I think this is a way of bringing people into the tent, and hopefully this show might do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Very well said. Stella, I was thinking you look a bit like in this episode and towards the end of the last one, a modern day Chopin or something like that in terms of the costume. You look like a modern day, like, you know, did you have that vibe when you put on the wig and stuff that you could be, I don't know, in a Vienna hall or something?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's not a very good actor. He plays the character pretty well anyway. But he made a choice when doing this flamboyant guy. Maybe it was a bad choice. I don't know. But he did it, and he has to live with it.
Yeah, I've spoken to Joel Edgerton and Fiona Shaw in this job, both of whom have been in iterations of Star Wars, and they've both said it's a different level of fandom. You know, I've been in big movies and TV shows, but Star Wars is wild. Stellan, have you been struck by, maybe you're pretty famous anyway, but, you know, and married to an Irish woman, so you're in good company here, but have you been surprised by the level of fandom of Star Wars?
Well, I've slowly got used to it by doing the pirates and by doing the Mamma Mias and doing it is wild. I'm not going out much now, so I don't have to meet them.
That Irish wife is keeping you at home, clearly, you know.
Yes, she is.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's a fantastic show. And I didn't mention season two is terrific. And I love the way it continues on season one. So continued success to both of you, and good luck with Andor 2.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stellan Skarsgård there, talking about the fame of Star Wars and his fame in general. And you also heard me talking there to Tony Gilroy, the creator, the showrunner on Andor, for the second season, streaming from next week, the 23rd of April on Disney Plus, Emmy nominated. So that'll give you a sense of it. Well worth a watch. And season two continues in a pretty great vein as well. And we've Ben Mendelsohn entering the fray, which is great. So I didn't give too much away about the plot. They're very keen that we don't. You will enjoy it, particularly if you enjoyed the first season. And as I say, it's on Disney Plus from next week, the 23rd of April. After the break, we review the week's new cinema releases, including the much talked about Alex Garland movie, Warfare. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time. We turn to the week's new cinema releases, and we are talking about movies of two great directors, Ryan Coogler, his latest movie, Sinners, and Alex Garland, he who wrote 28 Days Later and directed last year's brilliant Civil War, his new movie, Warfare, which is getting a lot of attention. To make sense of all this, I'm joined by regular reviewer on this show, film critic and arts journalist, Chris Wasser. Chris, hello, sir.
John, how are you?
Very well. So, Ryan Coogler,
yes.
The man who gave us Creed, the man who also gave us Wakanda, Black Panther, all that stuff. Brilliant director. He likes to have Michael B. Jordan in his movies. Well, certainly the Creed movies. So what's going on in Sinners?
Yeah, you know what? He actually does. And this isn't the first time that I will compare the two boys to Scorsese and De Niro. But there is
there's a new rule on this show. Whenever you say De Niro, you have to refer to him as my good friend, Robert De Niro.
Your good friend, Robert De Niro. Yeah, because we talked recently about De Niro doing the dual performance shtick, and that's what Michael B. Jordan is doing here. But there is something of a Scorsese-De Niro-like collaboration between Coogler and Michael B. Jordan, in that, you know, they have collaborated five times at this stage on various big screen projects, and that they also bring out the best in one another. And I think this might be actually their sharpest project to date. So I should say straight away that I'm not going to be spoiling anything here, because there's been a lot of talk about this film and about the fact that it doesn't really kind of show, you know, its true colors until the second half, and it doesn't reveal itself to be a horror until the second half. But the horror element and the fact that Ryan Coogler has made this original, you know, vampire, American vampire film is all over the marketing materials, John. It's all over the trailer. It's in the poster. So we're not doing anything wrong here. But we are going back to 1930s Mississippi. We're following Miles Caden, who is an R&B singer in real life, making his acting debut here, very impressively so, as a young man named Sammy Moore, who just wants to play the blues for a living. And his father is a preacher, and, you know, so naturally he's against this, and he just wants his son to kind of follow in his path. The last thing he wants is for him to be spending time with his cousins, Smoke and Stack. And Smoke and Stack are these kind of, you know, very well-dressed but shady gangster types who've spent the last few years following the war in Chicago. There's suggestions at some point that they may have been working for Al Capone, but we don't really know. But they're back. They're both played by Michael B. Jordan. It's nowhere near as gimmicky as the De Niro stuff, you know, that your good friend did in the Alto Nights. But they're back to open up their own juke joint in the Mississippi Delta. And they're in a real hurry, John. They want to do it that night. You know, they've acquired the property. They've acquired the beer in their cousin, Sammy. They've acquired some entertainment. They'll need some maybe more experienced players. But in order to make it to opening night, they'll have to get past various complications because, you know, a few criminal obstacles they'll have to overcome. But a very long story short, they make it to opening night. The last thing they expect to happen at their big opening is for a group of pale, redneck, racist vampires to knock on the door.
Okay, and that's what happens. And come here, I read something that there is this legend of Robert Johnson making a deal with the devil to play the blues. That lurks somewhere in this.
Yeah, that element is I mean, if you are familiar with that tale that, you know, Robert Johnson is said to, you know, at a crossroads of, you know, encountered this devil and, you know, was handed this guitar that was tuned in a sort of way that would ensure that he would go off and get, you know, fulfill his dream of becoming this legendary blues man, but, you know, he'd also sold his soul in the process. That is very much there, you know, and there's all sorts of fun with these legends that, you know, from the very beginning, this narration that informs us that some people have the ability to play the sort of music that, you know, awakens spirits from the past and from the future. But it's not, you know, there's no kind of, nobody at any stage is referring to that story at all. This is very much it's an original tale. It's easy to see, you know, you don't need me to explain to you what Ryan Coogler is doing here. The idea of, you know, these two African-American men, you know, having fought in the war and tried to make a life for themselves in the big city, returning home to, you know, create a business in a place in America that they believe that maybe, you know, has changed for the best, but then really hasn't. You know, the very second that they try and create something for themselves, you know, you have these racist hooligans knocking on the door. It just so happens that Coogler has sort of done what, you know, other filmmakers like, for instance, Jordan Peele has done, in that they've added a horror element to kind of really hammer that home. And I think it works brilliantly.
Why does it work so brilliantly?
It's very well performed for a start. It's the confidence off of this thing. I mean, what Coogler and Jordan are giving us here is an original blockbuster with a beginning, a middle, and an end. At no point in this thing are you thinking this thing is hoping to be sequelized or franchised. Yeah. It's just shooting for the stars and doing what it needs to in the two and a bit hours that we have here. There's no kind of like world building for later installments, and I love that. I think the fact that so much time, the first hour, John, is spent establishing this sort of real world premise where if you knew nothing, if you didn't listen to this review, I hope you are, and you didn't know the vampires are involved, you could leave after the first half and think, well, that was actually a really compelling, gangster tale set in a real version of the 1930s Mississippi. You know, it's authentic. It looks fantastic. It was all shot on film. The way that the characters are speaking to one another, you know, there's a few hints every now and then that there might be something scary, you know, lurking around the corner, but it just feels lived in. It feels real. But then when it actually gets to the vampire stuff, it's all out. It's ballsy. It's so confident. There are visual risks here that, and also, you know, audio risks that pay off. What I mean by that is there's one sequence in here where Ryan Coogler turns this barrel house into a vision from the past and the future. So while the blues music is playing out, this idea that these players are able to maybe awaken spirits, you have dancers and musicians from hundreds of years ago from a different continent playing alongside the blues players. And then you also have blues legends of the future and hip hop artists performing. And if it sounds bananas, it is, but it works brilliantly. And then outside the juke joint, you've got the vampires, who also happen to be Irish, led by Jack O'Connell, singing Rocky Road to Dublin and taunting their prey with the, with those sort of like you know, ancient Irish tunes. It's bananas, John. But it
but worked. Good bananas.
Oh, but good bananas. It's all managed so tightly. It's performed so well, so enthusiastically by Michael B. Jordan. I actually believed him in the dual role. It's not at all gimmicky. I love this. I love that it really just, everyone involved just throws everything at this to create something original, to create something fun, to create something that's genuinely frightening, that's visually spectacular, that sounds amazing, and that's never for a second boring. I had a great time with this.
Wow, this sounds great. And I'm just, as you're talking there, reminded somewhat of Tarantino's, yes, the one he wrote From Dawn Till Dusk, as in it switches halfway through to something very different and there's guys kind of up to no good. Is it aping that, or it's very much its own thing? It sounds.
Yeah, I did. I took a note of that halfway through, because when Jack O'Connell's Remick enters the equation, you kind of, at first you're thinking, oh, this is the kind of guy who usually messes things up for characters hoping to, you know, create their own business. And you kind of know, notice it's so subtly done that there's smoke coming off his shoulders and there's menace brewing in his eyes, and you think to yourself, hold on, this guy's a vampire. And it becomes something completely different, the same way that Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino, they surprised you, you know, they delayed that big reveal, yeah, that, you know, Clooney and Tarantino had walked into this vampire joint. There are obviously going to be similar, are obviously going to be comparisons there. People will have their, you know, make similarities, but I think Sinners is a stronger film. You know, there are cleverer themes here, mm-hmm, cleverer real world themes. I think the narrative is tidier.
And just on route to you giving me your rating of it, we're not to be offended as Irish people that the vampires are Irish, are,
no,
they? Are we? No.
No, okay. Not at all. No. I thought, well, you know, from maybe in the first bar when Jack O'Connell started singing when Rocky Road to Dublin, I thought, uh-oh, where are we going here? But it's actually a fabulous rendition, which, okay, which some of the main characters then join in on, some of the characters in the Duke joint. Put it this way, John, I actually will seek out the soundtrack for this.
Wow, okay, that sounds good. That's high praise indeed coming away from a movie. So without further ado, what are you going to say stars-wise for Sinners, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 18th of April?
Yeah, I think it's sensational to look at. I think it's extraordinary to listen to. I think it defies genre, commits itself to that just absolutely bananas, as I say for the third time, gonzo premise. It's a full five for me. I think, wow. I just think, you know, this is the kind of blockbuster that I do want to see in cinemas. You know, not another comic book adaptation, which Jordan has done, which Coogler has done. You know, not something based on something original. And that's what we're getting here.
Wow, 5 stars. He's gone the full 5. I'm going to go the full Pat Kenny and go, wow. So we better take a clip of Sinners.
Why you can't just walk your big ass up in here without an invite, huh? Go ahead. Admit to it.
Admit to what?
That you dead.
So you listening to this? Now we out here playing games, telling ghost stories in place of doing what we ought to do.
And what is it we supposed to be doing?
Being kind to one another and being polite. Now we is one people, and we shouldn't go in barging into other folks' places uninvited. So
we've been in and out of here all day. Ain't never need an invite then. Yeah, something ain't adding up.
That is a clip of Sinners with Michael B. Jordan playing two cousins. Is it twins or two cousins?
Twins. Sorry, they're cousins to the blues player, yeah.
So they would be two then if they were twins, I guess.
Yes.
So that is 5 stars, a whopping 5 stars for Sinners, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 18th of April. Something, well, very different, certainly different. War of a different kind, a much more serious war, I guess, is Warfare, Alex Garland. What I'm reading about this, Chris, unfortunately I haven't got to see it and I really would like to, is that this is a really in-your-face war movie and its attempt is to show you the claustrophobic nature of modern warfare.
That's it. That's it in a nutshell. I mean, war is hell, and this film just goes above and beyond to prove that. To the point where it's almost unbearably tense at times and quite difficult to watch. That though might be something that Garland and Ray Mendoza, his collaborator here, would be pleased to hear, because Alex Garland is obviously going to, you know, get the headlines here, but this is very much a collaboration between two different filmmakers. You know, it was written and directed by Ray Mendoza. Now, who is Ray Mendoza? He was, he's involved in stunt coordination, but he was also the battle scene choreographer and consultant on Civil War. And he worked very closely, obviously, alongside Alex Garland on Civil War. But they talked a little about the fact that he himself is a former US Navy SEAL. And they had their conversations about missions and whatnot while they were making Civil War. But it was after they finished shooting that, that's going back to 2023, another film was only released last year, that Garland asked him to, you know, let's talk a little bit. Let's talk, go deeper into those stories that you were talking to me about, and let's see if we can develop a project together. So Mendoza shared the story about how his platoon had become trapped in November 2006 in an urban residential area in Ramadi province in Iraq, where the U.S. soldiers, they were doing this, I want to say, routine surveillance mission that, you know, they were basically going into a residential area, going into a house, asking the family to stay in the bedroom. The soldiers would stay there and just scope out the area and keep an eye out for Al-Qaeda forces, because they had an operation coming through that area the following day, and they wanted to make sure there was no threat. Unfortunately, there was a threat. The soldiers were quite surprised when a grenade came into, you know, the building where they were stationed. A handful of them were seriously injured. There were further explosions. So what started out as a surveillance mission turned into, you know, a much needed evacuation operation. So this real life mission was turned into what we see in warfare then. And it's based entirely on Mendoza's memories and also the memories of the soldiers who spoke to both Garland and Mendoza. So basically, that's a long way of saying, John, that everything you see in this film really did happen.
Okay. But obviously, it's fictionalized up for the cameras, and we have some actors playing the various components. Is there a lead actor in this?
Not really, no. But the thing is, they've been talking, Mendoza and Garland have been talking about how, you know, they watch other war films that romanticize and kind of, you know, there's a bit of a, you know, gung-ho element to you know, what it's like to, you know, be a part of a brotherhood in war. There's not really any of that here at all. There's not much dialogue here at all that isn't technical. There's no real characterization. Any sort of narrative has just been stripped. I mean, like Garland and Mendoza, the screenplay that they wrote, as I say, everything is from memory. So they just eschew conventional narrative methods altogether. Instead, you've got very famous actors. And then in cases also actors, you know, you might sit there and go, oh, I know that person from something, and I know this actor from that project. You've got Charles Melton. You've got Cosmo Jarvis. He's excellent here as this sniper who ends up in a very bad way. You've got Will Poulter involved. You've got a future George Harrison, Joseph Quinn in there too. And nobody, you never really get to kind of know anything about these men. You just watch as they try to help one another get out of this horrible, horrible situation that goes south very, very quickly. You remember a few years back, Kajaki?
Yes.
About the British soldiers who inadvertently walked into a minefield, and the whole film is placed in this real time where how do you get out of that? You know, every step could sort of lead to your death. It's a little bit like that. I remember
there is no exposition as in where these characters came from or any of that stuff.
No.
Is it in real time?
It is, save for a section at the beginning where we see the soldiers bonding and we see them going into the building, and then a section at the end. The 90 minutes in between, it is quite short. That's all in real time. Now, did I miss that conventional narrative? I did, and I do think that, you know, that it maybe pushes a bit harder time. From a technical standpoint, it's extraordinarily well made. And it does, you know, reinforce that idea that, you know, everyone knows that war is hell, and that this is what these young men, this is the kind of thing that these young men are walking into. I think it missed an opportunity, though, because it doesn't really, you know, all of these years later, it doesn't really have anything to say about this war. And, you know, the lives that it affected, sorry. And what happened to those men afterwards. I think it's completely immersive, and, you know, it's a very difficult watch, intentionally so, but it just felt a little bit incomplete. It felt sometimes like I was watching this really shaky found footage film. It doesn't look like that, but I felt like that, like that it's just kind of all snippets from a story that I wish I knew more about.
Okay. And I gather you know, you've already alluded to it. It is very gritty and
yes.
grim, to the point that we see soldiers, if I'm to understand it correctly, like losing the run of their bowels. God bless them.
It's very difficult to watch.
Yeah.
You know, and also the sound design in this film. I mean, it's deafening at times.
Right.
It is quite gory. You know, I did feel a little bit queasy watching it, but again, I think perhaps Garland and Mendoza would, I think the least they're expecting is for people to say, well, it's a tough watch. If that's the case, then they've done their job correctly. I just think it was missing that narrative. I think it was mm-hmm. missing, you know, it missed the opportunity to say something about the war in Iraq. I also think there's a sequence over the end credits, and normally we don't really talk about these things, but I think we can here, where we're shown some footage from behind the scenes, and also a surviving soldier visiting the set, and it's all kind of handshakes mm-hmm. and hugs, and it's bonding with the cast members. That didn't sit well with me at all. I thought that was a little bit, that took me out of things. I know it's over the credits, but that took me out of things altogether. The fact that everyone was kind of, you know, standing around and smiling after everything that we just watched, I just didn't like that at all.
Okay. So it sounds like, you know, this is a masterclass in showing you that
yes.
war is hell, and also, you know, the idea of making a different type of movie where there is no narrative or exposition and you're right in it. But that narrative loss, you felt somewhat significantly. So what are you going to say stars-wise for Warfare?
Yeah, I think it's so well made. It's immersive, experiential, and experimental. And, you know, I am glad that, you know, Garland and Ray Mendoza, I look forward to seeing what he does next, you know, that there are directors and filmmakers taking risks like
yeah.
that. I just think it just feels incomplete, and I wasn't happy with some of the decisions in it. So I'm going to go with a solid 3. I would encourage people to go and see this, but also just prepare yourself too, because I did find it very difficult to watch.
That's very interesting, because I was actually about to say, I hear why you're giving it 3 stars, but I still want to see this because
yes.
I want to see what you're talking about. So hopefully listeners to this show who trust in you will feel the same way. So that is 3 stars for Warfare from Chris. And before that, he gave Sinners a whopping 5. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
Up next, a fascinating new documentary all about the confession box called Sins of Ireland. Now, you're welcome back to the last part of Screen Time. Opening in many cinemas around the country this weekend, this Friday, is Sins of Ireland, which offers an exploration of the Catholic Church in Ireland through the lens of the sacrament of confession. Yes, the confession box, as a way of understanding our past as well as where we are now and maybe where the church and us as a society might be going. The film features 15 priests who offer their views on confession and what the sacrament might mean and how it's been used and possibly abused over the years. And I suppose the documentary highlights the turbulent changes in faith and spirituality in contemporary Ireland. It's from Alex Fegan, who previously gave us 2 great documentaries, Older Than Ireland, all about, well, old people in Ireland, most of whom were over 100, if I'm not mistaken, and a glorious documentary, which I hope we'll talk about briefly, called The Irish Pub. And I'm delighted to say Alex joins me in studio. Alex, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you very much.
So listen, most interviews start with, why did you want to make this? But I have to ask, why did you want to go to a topic that could be so contentious, certainly so problematic from our collective past, which you and I share as probably a similar age, growing up in Catholic Ireland? Why?
Well, I suppose it's never a good reason not to do something because it's contentious or because it's controversial.
Good point.
It's probably the right reason to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah, certainly for a filmmaker.
Yeah, exactly. And we're at a time now at the moment where the Catholic Church is not exactly the coolest thing, especially with all, as you said, all that's been revealed over the last 40 years, certainly. Mm. Just so much stuff. And so I just kind of thought that there was so much looking at it from the outside, so many experts commenting on it. But I hadn't heard anything just from the average priest who were at the forefront of it. And this was an opportunity to do that.
And where did you find these 15 priests?
So essentially...
Don't say a church.
No. So I was looking for... The idea was to make a film that was about honest introspection. So I want... So the confession box was at the core of that. So it was key to find priests that actually hear confessions. So I basically Googled different counties and said, who's listening to confessions in Kerry at the moment? Who's listening to confessions in Galway or Belfast or Dublin? And that's how it happened. It was the first names that popped up that were hearing confessions, and then I gave them a call.
Young filmmakers of Ireland, take note. Google. It's a wonderful tool. So look, the thing is, right, and maybe I'm playing devil's advocate here, but one thing that strikes me, and I really enjoyed the film, so you're on safe ground here, but they're all very right on, as in they're all, I think to a man, and they are all men, obviously, critical of the church, regretful of things they may have said in the confession box over the years. So you've chosen people who are very critical and reflective about the church. I presume that was a conscious decision. Or why did you not have a kind of dyed-in-the-wool Vatican I guy?
Because I couldn't find any.
Really?
So it was actually a case of, and I did this as well with Older in Ireland and the Irish Pope. I try not to cast at all, because if you're casting, then you're picking people that suit your particular
narrative.
So
if you don't cast, what's the alternative?
The alternative is basically the first random people that you contact.
Okay.
They're the ones you go with.
Okay.
And so that's the conscious decision.
Guerrilla filmmaking.
It is, yeah. It's kind of what they come out with is what the film will reveal. And that's, for me, the best way to get an authentic experience from these particular priests.
Yeah.
So I suppose... Yes, they were critical of the church, but they were also priests. They stayed within the church.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that kind of, I suppose maybe it's the questions I'm asking as well. Where do you see things falling short? Because we're talking about sin, and that the whole idea of that is about falling short. So, and then they would just address it in an honest way, and that's kind of how that emerged.
By the way, I read retrospective. One or two of them have subsequently passed away. I was just curious, have any of them left?
No.
Okay, interesting. No. You have as well, I think it's the youngest newly ordained priest in Ireland, a guy up
north. That's right, yeah, Father Conor McGrath.
He's a find.
Yeah, he was amazing. He was, as a friend of mine said, in the promotion of this film, he rang him up and he said, he is speaking on a different frequency. There's a calmness about him.
Yeah.
And just almost a spiritual calmness about him, which is so true.
Yeah.
So he's now on the Falls Road in Belfast. He's the parish priest there.
In the thick of it. So you're discussing confession with them. And as I mentioned, you know, some of them have regrets about things they may have said at the time. But I suppose maybe shocking is overstating it. But when it gets to the confessional seal, it's very interesting, because they are, most of them, I think, intimated this. They will keep secret what they hear, because that's the very nature of it. And one of them implies they heard talk of pedophilia. Now, they may encourage people to do the right thing and go to the police and all that kind of thing, but they will not break the seal. And, you know, we don't have to get into the ethics of that. But was that, well, or maybe we can, but was that uncomfortable filming that?
Initially, I was just really curious about it, and I was kind of thinking, surely in those circumstances you would. But his explanation kind of reassured me a little bit, because, you know, what he was talking about was, you know, this is an opportunity. Mm. Somebody that goes to confession in that circumstances is suffering in conscience, and this might be a moment where it could turn them around.
Mm.
Now, as he said, so the seal will never be broken.
Mm.
Now, if the seal could be broken in certain circumstances, he wouldn't have gone to confession in the first place. So therefore, he wouldn't have had the opportunity to go to police anyway.
Yeah.
But the opportunity for that turnaround wouldn't be there. So I suppose that's the kind of general worldly logic to it.
Mm.
In a spiritual sense, obviously, this particular particular priest says, look, this is not me offering forgiveness. Because I was like, hey, it must be really hard for you to offer forgiveness in a situation like that. And he said, yes, if I think the forgiveness is Joe's as opposed to Jesus's. Mm. So that was his answer.
Yeah. Well, there's a logic in that. Not everyone may agree, but, you know, they are signed up members of the Catholic Church who believe in the seal of confession. So they do have a logic. Tell me this. A lot of it was clearly happening during COVID.
Yes.
So you've had this for a while then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it was a documentary that kind of got halted during COVID. And then I was kind of thinking, well, this is an opportunity to kind of visually show how the church can adapt in certain circumstances. So here were these priests not being able to reach their parishioners, if you like, but they had to use all sorts of technology and Zooms and everything to kind of say Mass and stuff like that. So it was a good way to kind of show how a very conservative institution who is still dominated by, as you said, male celibate tend to be older people now actually adapting, which shows that these things are possible.
And in fairness, they all, I think, again, to a man, kind of said, it's rather absurd we don't have women who can also do this. Just, you mentioned that adapting to the future. And I don't want to make this sound like, because the documentary isn't pessimistic, but a lot of the priests are quite pessimistic about the future of the church, I think it's fair to say, aren't they, of the 15?
Yeah, I think of the clerical church, they're
that's a good distinction.
Yeah, they're pessimistic. Like some of them would say, okay, look, the church might get smaller and it actually, you know, it might ultimately shed some of the baggage of its past. And then out of this might come something that's a better thing for the church, but then it will be corrupted again, as institutions always are, and it'll fall again. And that's kind of the idea of it. It's the rise and fall, which is similar to people in general. We're all
indeed. And what institutions do not rise and fall to some extent? Tell me this, not to do amateur Freudianism on you, but your first movie I mentioned there was Older in Ireland, about people in their 100th year and beyond. Then The Irish Pub, you know, which is under threat of sorts, as much as we love it all. And now this movie about confession and priests. You clearly are drawn to topics that you think aren't maybe getting the attention they deserve, or on the fringes, or not in mainstream media, or what's your rationale and what you choose?
It's a really good question. You're always looking for the universal in the particular. So like, we did a film called Abbey Feelgood, which was about 16 barbers and hairdressers on two streets in Abbey Feel.
Wow, Abbey Feel and Kerry.
Yeah, on the border there.
Oh, the border. Yes.
But obviously this through the confession book. So just looking for, can you say something about human beings at large, whether it's honest introspection through the confession box. So I like, whether it's like the Catholic Church, or you're trying to be objective about these things, I've no sway either way, but what you're trying to say is, can you say something about who we are as people through these prisms? Same with Older in Ireland and The Irish Pub, keeping traditions alive.
You certainly can. And one thing I meant to say to you, just to go back to sin, it seems every priest really does not, as much as they believe in the power a confession may present to someone, they really don't like the thought of a confession box. Like, one guy would love to do it out in the car park and stuff.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The confession box is a thing of the past to a lot of priests. It's, you know, think of the baggage that came out of these confession boxes, the abuses that happened in the confession boxes, the obsession with sexual sins. Yeah. Like, they would all talk about that. And this idea of, what sins did you do? What number are they? You know, it was all an inquiry into the details. Absolutely, like, the box represents that. Whereas now they tend to want to hear confession, say, in a pew or in a room that's bright and whatnot.
Tell me this, The Irish Pub, I really like that one because I guess we all love, or a lot of us love, The Irish Pub. Like, that's a while ago now. You probably don't think about it that often, or maybe you do, but like, it seems to me the pubs you featured in that wonderful documentary are probably more under threat than they were the 3 years ago that came out. Are you, what's your thought on that now?
Yeah, I'm saddened by it. I think this generic world we're heading into, where everything's the same, every shop is the same, every pub is going to be, you know, the same, you know, every chemist is the same, every and like, if you think of all the small, there used to be like 5,000 individual small shops around Ireland. Now there's like 7 brands, if you like. Where's the creativity? Where's the character? Where's the individuality? And I'm kind of, that kind of stuff really scares me. That idea of throwing the baby out with the bathwater is something that I suppose resonates as well, which goes back as well to confession.
Yeah.
Where's the baby in the dirty water?
Yeah, indeed. Dirty water is a good analogy. Well, one thing is definitely not generic, and that is the documentaries of Alex Fegan, who is in studio with me today talking about Sins of Ireland, which is, I was going to say, on selected release, but nothing could be further from the truth, because it's going to be in around 23 cinemas all over Ireland. So that is general release. That's as general as they come. I think Avatar probably had something similar. So The Sins of Ireland is a fantastic watch. Alex, thanks a lot for coming into studio.
Thank you so much, John.
Four confessional boxes in the church, and the four of them now are all used as storage spaces.
The practice of confession is regarded as an Irish innovation.
Well, it was one of our contributions, the confession box.
When a penitent goes to confession, they're going to Jesus in the person of the priest, and they have a chance to be renewed and be forgiven of all their sins.
And possibly the greatest potential for good in a person's life was a good confessor. And of course, vice versa, few could do greater damage than a bad one. And I'm afraid we had a lot of emphasis on the latter, in this country especially.
And then there were abuses. What are the confessional boxes? Because women were unsafe for some of the priests.
It became a traumatic, terrifying experience for many people.
A clip there from Sins of Ireland, which, as I was saying to Alex Fegan, is on pretty general release in 23 cinemas. So if it is in your cinema, wherever you may be in this fair isle, do check it out. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. We'll do it all again next week. If you really want to hear more from me, Monday evening, there's a Best of Screen Time at 6 p.m. on News Talk, where you'll be hearing some of my chats with people like Robert De Niro and Angelina Jolie. You know me, I like to hide my light under a bushel. But in the meantime, have a happy Easter. Enjoy the rest of this Easter weekend, and I will talk to you all next week.